Well, thank you for your patience and your time in joining us here at the United States Institute of Peace. We'd like to first thank all of the staff and friends that helped us rearrange this room hectically and so we can have it properly as you are seated. Second, I'd like to thank our guest speakers who've come very far to join us on this important event. My name is Qamar al-Huda, and I'm in the Religion and Peacemaking Program here at the USIP. And just a brief background note, many of you know about us, some of you don't, but the Institute is an independent, nonpartisan, national institution established by the Congress and funded by Congress. And our mission is very simple, to help prevent, manage, and resolve conflicts around the world by empowering with knowledge and skills and resources towards peace-building efforts. I will make this as quick as possible because we are moving ahead and a bit short of time. And this program and seminar on Islamic reform will be a series of programs and seminars ongoing for the next year on examining recent contributions on the meaning of Islamic reform and the context of that, and what it meant for that particular cultural context, and ideas dealing with constitutionalism, Islamic law, Quranic tafsir or interpretation. So this is our first seminar. I'd like to give the mic to our senior fellow, Jennings Randolph Senior Fellow, Al-Bakir Mukhtar.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I would like to welcome you all to this seminar on Islamic reform ideas of the Sudanese reformer Mahmoud Muhammad Taha. Our seminar comes as the fairest, as my colleague Qamar has just told you, in a series of an Islamic reform events that the U.S. Institute of Peace is planning. The idea behind these seminars is to introduce to you the internal debates among Muslims and to show that the traditional or conservative Islam and the extreme Islam, i.e. that the Islam that catches the attention of the media, is not the only one out there. Homegrown reform ideas and social movements do exist and have always existed, although they went unnoticed by the outside world. The Republican movement, which was founded and led by Mahmoud Muhammad Taha, is not only just one of these movements, but it is also the most comprehensive, visionary, and revolutionary among them. We decided to start our series with Mahmoud Muhammad Taha for a specific reason. And that is because these days coincide with the 21st anniversary of his heroic death that took place on the 18th of January 1985. Taha was executed for opposing Nimeiri's sudden and ill-conceived imposition of Islamic laws that threw the whole country into turmoil and caused the resumption and intensification of the civil war. When fear and intimidation prevailed over the country and silenced almost all the political leaders, Taha stood up to the dictator in defense of the downtrodden Sudanese masses who had suffered death, crucifixion, and cross amputation in what was criminally claimed to be the enforcement of Islamic law. He exposed the dictator's lies to the public. He humiliated his judicial system, treated his courts and judges with the contempt that they deserve for making mockery of the law. And he offered his life in the course of human freedom and dignity. So who is this man? and what are his ideas? Our distinguished panelists are here to answer these questions. However, I shall also assist them by providing you with a background information about the man. But before doing that, let me introduce to you our distinguished speakers. And since their biographies have been provided for you, and since I also know them personally for a long time, I'm going to share with you a little bit of what I know about them, which is not included in the bios. Let me start with Dr. Ernest. Dr. Ernest B. Johnson II has a profound Sudanese experience. He lived among the Republicans and participated in all their activities for a number of years during the 1980s. His command of Sudanese colloquial Arabic is outstanding. Ernest is going to talk to us about Islam as a viable way of life in the 21st century. Next to him is Dr. Stephen Howard. Dr. Howard also lived in Sudan for most of the decade of the 1980s, and he spent most of his time with Mahmoud Muhammad Taha and his followers. Steve authored several articles about Mahmoud Muhammad Taha and his movement. And as a student of sociology, Steve did his PhD studying a Sudanese community in a small village that is unknown to most of the Sudanese. I myself came first to know about this village from Steve himself. I also must say that Steve's command of Sudanese colloquial Arabic is remarkable. The matter that allowed him to communicate with ordinary people, and especially elderly men and women, and earn him a lot of friends among the villagers. Steve is going to talk to us about Mahmoud Muhammad Taha's theology of liberation. Next to him is our third and last speaker, Dr. Al-Noor Hamad. Al-Noor is an assistant professor of art education at Mansfield University, PA. He wrote extensively in modernity and the vital need for an Islamic reform. Besides being an artist who held a number of art exhibitions, he's also a thinker and an incisive debater. And Noor's contribution to this panel is to discuss Mahmoud Muhammad Taha's position on the Arab-Israeli conflict. Let's thank our panelists for being with us here today, and we are looking forward to their contributions. Now, please allow me to provide you with a brief background about the man whom we are dedicating this seminar to his work and life. The title given to Mahmoud Muhammad Taha by his followers and the Sudanese people is Al-Ustaz. Al-Ustaz is an Arabic word which means the revered teacher or the spiritual master. Al-Ustaz, as a word, it indicates the utmost intellectual and spiritual authority of the great Sufi leaders, and at the same time it has a modernist tint to it that distinguishes him from the traditional Sufi sheikhs. Al-Ustaz Mahmoud was born in 1909 in a Sufi family to a peasant father from a small village on the eastern bank of the Blue Nile in central Sudan. He had his education in a Quranic school known as Khalwa until the age of 10, when, following the death of his father, he moved to live with his aunt in the town of Rufa'a, where he had the opportunity to go to one of the very few schools established by the British colonial authority. Al-Ustaz Mahmoud graduated from the engineering school of Gordon Memorial College, now the University of Khartoum, in 1936. Following a short period of service with Sudan Railways, he resigned and went into civil engineering practice in 1941. He was active in the nationalist struggle for independence from the beginning of this movement in the late 1930s. Al-Ustaz and other intellectuals formed the Republican Party in October 1945. The party's policy of direct and open confrontation with the colonial authorities led to the arrest and subsequent imprisonment of Al-Ustaz Mahmoud in 1946. He was imprisoned twice in the same year, but it was his second imprisonment that profoundly changed his life, the course of his life, and led to his dramatic death 4 decades later. It was during these 2 years of imprisonment and the subsequent 3 years of self-imposed religious seclusion, khalwa, in his hometown Rufa'a, that Al-Ustaz Mahmoud undertook spiritual exercises in the Sufi methods of worship that led to his insights into the meaning of the Quran. Many years later, Al-Ustaz looked back at the time he spent in prison, and he said the following: "When I arrived in prison, I felt that I came for an appointment with my Lord, so I decided to devote myself to him, using my prison cell as a khalwa for seclusion. At the end of my 2-year prison term, I realized that I got some of what I wanted to achieve in my life. And while I was on my way back home to Rufa'a, I felt that I had to continue my seclusion in order to complete what I had started. So, did I go into seclusion seeking knowledge? No, definitely not. I went into seclusion for something nobler than knowledge, something that knowledge is only a means to. And this is myself, which I lost in a heap of illusion and falsehoods. I had to search for it in the light of the Quran. I wanted to find it, to unfold it, and to be in peace with it before I can call others to Islam. This is extremely essential because who do not have cannot deliver." End of quote. By the end of his period of seclusion in October 1951, Al-Ustaz Mahmoud emerged with a comprehensive new conception of Islam, or what he called the second message of Islam, and which our speakers will explain to us. Through his Republican Party, Al-Ustaz Mahmoud established a new school of politics that represented a dramatic departure from the usual way politics has been practiced in Sudan and elsewhere. He revived, developed, and modernized an exemplary and modernized an old tradition of Sudanese Sufi leaders who transformed their communities by exemplary ethical guidance and by empowering the masses through knowledge. Al-Ustaz Mahmoud authored most of his books, more than 30 titles, between the mid-1960s and the early 1970s. Salient among his books are The Second Message of Islam, The Quran, The Message of Prayer, Evolution of the Family Law, and The Middle Eastern Problem. Most of the subsequent publications, which are more than 100 titles, were authored by his followers. Al-Ustaz Mahmoud's activities and his growing support among the people, and especially young educated men and women, was very alarming to the religious establishment inside and outside Sudan. It is also alarming to the traditional sectarian ruling parties and to the Muslim Brotherhood. So it was not surprising that internal and external influences united in an effort to silence Al-Ustaz Mahmoud and his organization. That conspiracy became apparent in 1968 when his enemies used a Sharia court to declare him apostate. And although Al-Ustaz Mahmoud refused to appear before that court, nevertheless, the court declared him apostate in absentia in a proceeding that lasted less than half an hour. Of course, since Sudan had a secular system of governance at that time, this declaration remained without any formal consequences apart from the negative publicity. However, the conspiracy against the life of Al-Ustaz Mahmoud continued unabated, and the plotters seized the golden opportunity provided by an isolated and besieged dictator who ran out of options. And in his desperation to prolong his rule, he imposed Sharia laws on his impoverished nation in September 1983. Al-Ustaz Mahmoud did not hesitate to amount his campaign against President Nimeiri's arbitrary Islamization policy. He issued on the Christmas day of 1984 a leaflet titled Hada Awa Tawafan, either this or the deluge, demanding repeal of the new laws and a guarantee of democratic civil liberties under which the Sudanese people could have an informed debate on the principles and processes of building their political and legal system on Islam. This leaflet led to the detention and trial of Al-Ustaz Mahmoud, who boycotted the court. And in announcing his decision to boycott the proceedings, Al-Ustaz Mahmoud improvised a strong statement before the court that went as follows. I have repeatedly declared my views that the September 1983 so-called Islamic laws violate Islam itself. Moreover, these laws have distorted Islamic Sharia and projected it in a repugnant way. Furthermore, these laws were enacted and utilized by the government to terrorize the Sudanese people and humiliate them into submission. These laws also threatens the national unity of the country by discriminating against the non-Muslim segment of our society. This is my objection to these laws at the theoretical level. As at the practical level, the judges enforcing these laws lack the necessary professional qualification. They also have failed morally when they place themselves under the control of the executive authority, which use them to violate people's rights, to humiliate political opponents, and to insult intellect and intellectuals. For all these reasons, I am not prepared to cooperate with any court that had betrayed the independence of the judiciary and allowed itself to be a tool in the hand of the government to humiliate our people, insult thinkers and free thought, and persecute political opponents. The trial, which lasted less than 2 hours, concluded by passing the death sentence on Al-Ustaz Mahmoud. This ruling was hastily confirmed by the Special Court of Appeal and by the President, by President Nimeiri, who addressed the nation through national radio and TV on January 17, 1985, heaping more accusations against Al-Ustaz Mahmoud and ordering his execution to be carried out the following day. The day of his execution, Friday, the 18th of January, 1985, was the saddest day in the modern history of Sudan, where the Sudanese people witnessed their government simply using the judicial system to carry out a cold-blooded murder against a 76-year-old pacifist. On that day, the authorities mounted a major security operation around the prison where he is held, checked identities, and closely observed the several hundred people who came to watch the public execution. When Al-Ustaz Mahmoud was brought up the stairs of the gallows and the hood covering his face was removed for a few minutes, he is reported to have surveyed the crowd with a smile on his face. Following the execution, the body was taken by helicopter to an unknown destination. Later, it was reported that the body was buried in a shallow grave somewhere in the desert of Omdurman, west of Omdurman. Exactly 76 days later, the dictator was overthrown by a popular uprising inspired by the heroic stance of Al-Ustaz Mahmoud. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the man whose ideas our guest speakers are going to present to us in the next hour or so. So, welcome them again with me. Now I'm going to invite Dr. Stephen Howard to present his talk. Okay. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Abagar, for putting together this program and having the the vision to bring us together for this very awe-inspiring week and at this particular time, and also thanks to the U.S. Institute for Peace for encouraging this particular event. One thing I will point out is in that I have a few of my current and former students are here, and it says I'm at Ohio State University. I should point out before they do something non-peaceful that I'm actually at Ohio University, which is much older than Ohio State University and distinguished Midwestern institution. But I do that for my students who are here, so go Bobcats. Any case, everybody thinks anybody from Ohio is from Ohio State. I guess that's the issue. I'm a sociologist, not a theologian, but I think the one of the important issues for me is that the Republican movement, and under the leadership of Ustaz Mahmoud, very much teacher Mahmoud, everyone in the movement becomes a theologian. Everyone is very, very able and capable of speaking in an extremely articulate manner. Hatala hobobat, as one would say. Even the grandmothers can articulate what's going on in terms of the Republican idea, the Republican ideology, as it's referred to. And this remarkably accessible theology, it was not shrouded in the office of some mufti or in Al-Azhar or something. This was very much a lived theology, a theology that was applied on a daily basis by the followers of Ustaz Mahmoud. And I think what was particularly remarkable was it was very much inhaled. It was the blood and bone of these wonderful people. One thing I think is important to point out that I appreciate an objective of the U.S. Institute for Peace is that we're beginning to have some differentiation within Sudan about what is going on in that country. It is an enormous country, the largest in Africa, and we're starting to, obviously this is in the United States right now, we're starting to understand the difference between Sunni and Shia, complements of the Iraq conflict, but also I think with Sudan, we're beginning to get a sense of the enormous differentiation. And I do want to point out that this was very much a small movement, but distinguished and very well known, and to some extent heterodox in some ways, and consequently the circumstances that Dr. Obaga was just describing. But in terms of the accessibility of the movement's ideology, the idea that it wasn't just lofty books. Obaga mentioned the many books published by Ustaz and more than 200 titles published and distributed on the streets of Sudan by the followers of Al-Ustaz. The idea was not just enshrined in these books, but rather also lived on a daily basis. And what I have done for the great privilege of the half of my life that I've known about the Republicans and have lived with them is collect amazing stories. And I remember one case where which was extremely instrumental in my understanding of what was happening here. I was visiting the town of Rufaa that I frequently did, that Al-Bagr mentioned, Al-Ustaz's hometown, where his wife was from, where his wife's family was from. He grew up near Rufaa on the Blue Nile, south of Khartoum. And I was taking a walk with a friend of mine along the river. And approaching us from some distance was a man in the white jalabiya, the conventional dress for men in the country. And I knew this man who was approaching us, and my friend, Abdul Gadir, who I was walking with, poked me and said, Steve, pointing at this man, he said, "Steve Dashnuda, what is that?" And my Arabic was fairly rudimentary at that point, and I was always impressed that everybody was willing to teach me things. So I was a little bit nervous, thinking I was about to learn the Sudanese colloquial term for retarded or something, because that indeed this man was mentally handicapped. And so I, trying to avoid the subject, I shrugged my shoulders and hoped that we would move on to another topic. And but Abdelgader ignored my shrugging, and he said, "Steve, da dervish." And I was very, very impressed. He said, "That's a dervish." And so here, this my friend was describing this mentally handicapped man as a dervish, as someone who was constantly in a state of prayer, constantly in a state of barakah, as it were, somebody who was completely devoted to a particular tariqa or Sufi sect. And in fact, his notion of labeling him, calling him a dervish, was in fact, rather than labeling him as a retard or something that might come out of the lips of adolescents in this country, he gave him a term that he himself would aspire to. In other words, that my friend Abdelgader himself would be very happy if I referred to him as dervish, as somebody who was constantly involved with prayer and thinking about nothing but God all the time. So the point was that this was a community of possibility that would see the best in everybody, and to see that they were able to make some contribution to the community, and particularly to make an effort on their own behalf to get closer and closer to God. That was certainly the objective, that the theology that Ustaz Mahmoud iterated, that he laid out very clearly in daily meetings with his followers in a piece-by-piece, very excellent methodology. He would try to instruct his followers, expanding their knowledge of the possibilities that Islam presented. This was not an Islam of limitations, rather the vision that Muhammad Taha had of the faith was one that could lead to such great things that the human mind could hardly imagine it. In fact, one of his famous and favorite quotes that I have in a typically absent-minded professor pile here that I really think is, oh, here it is. This kind of summarizes the whole thing. He said, wrote in 1963, "The age-old dream of the human caravan is not to send astronauts in their orbit in the outer space. It is to send its individuals, every single individual, in his orbit of self-realization. It is high time that this dream be reinterpreted. It is also the sacred duty of every man and woman to help to intelligently reorient human endeavor towards the culmination of this pilgrimage." This was in a letter, sort of an interesting fun fact for the Washington scene. He wrote this in a letter in response to John Vole, who's the associate director of the Center for Christian Muslim Understanding at Georgetown, and in fact did his doctoral dissertation in Sudan. And this became a very important quote by the Republicans. Everybody memorized this and learned this particular phrase, because it encapsulated this future orientation, this idea that there could be possibilities in Islam, and that, in fact, ultimately, that following Tariq Muhammad, the path of the Prophet, that one could transform oneself and get closer and closer and closer to God. So one thing that I think is an extremely important part of this whole process is, as I said, it was not just a theology encapsulated in books put on dusty shelves, but rather the books themselves were dog-eared. They were passed around. I regularly would see them in the back, behind the back seat of a taxi, where some taxi driver had been reading it during his break times, or on piles of books in people's houses and so forth. And people would read these, pass them around in groups, and even find examples of people who couldn't read being read from these books, so that a wider and wider circle of people became knowledgeable about the viewpoint of Ustaz Mahmoud and the Republican Brotherhood. I also want to stress the amazing teaching ability of this man. His whole point was expanding knowledge and enormous respect for education, particularly for women to get access to education, to higher education, and he would proudly welcome graduates back to the house for small celebrations and so forth to honor the major achievement of a woman getting through some sort of university degree in particular. We have a number of them here this afternoon, mashallah. And I think a very interesting example of his teaching methods, which were not like everybody sit down in a class and listen to my lecture. It was a very engaged sort of process. Obviously, very frequently using the love of the Sudanese for their own culture. For example, through the Republican development of Inshad Irfani coming out of Sudanese Madih. These are spiritual poems, Qasaid, put to beautiful music, original music, in fact, and one of the major musicians is next to me here, Al Noor. So at one point, there was a morning meeting where the brothers and sisters were singing one of these beautiful hymns that related essentially to the difference between the notion of being and becoming, which, of course, were essential both Sufi ideas as well as important to this notion of transformation, which was a foundation of Mahmoud Muhammad Taha's thinking. Well, in the middle of the Qasida, in the middle of the song, Al-Ustaz stopped the singing, and he asked one of the he asked the general group that was sitting there in his room with him, maybe 40, 50 people in the crowd into the room to sing these songs in the morning. And so he said, well, who can tell me the difference between being and becoming? And different brothers and sisters raised their hands, and as they got the answer wrong, they'd say, no, no, no. And finally, someone got it right. And explained that a little bit further. But the point was that he was using this very favorite aspect of Sudanese culture to deliver an important instructional theological message to his followers. And therefore, and then you'd find people going about their busy days, their work, their domestic lives, their family existences, singing this particular hymn and very conscious of the this theological point that their teacher had made to them to start their day. So let me stop there and let somebody else talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Our next speaker is Ernest Johnson.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here and to see, you know, this illustrious turnout in honor of Ustaz Mahmoud Muhammad Taha, to learn more about his ideas. His ideas are what took me to Sudan. I was born into a Christian family. Ustaz Mahmoud pointed out to me that it was a religious family, and I was in Hawaii looking for answers. I was in my own search of self, and I ran into a Sudanese student by the name of Salman Al-Awad, and he was pointed out to me as being a good human being and a good Muslim. And I asked him questions about Islam, as I had just embraced Islam in 1975. And he started teaching me the basics of faith. And as I started to learn more, I started to become interested in the Sudan. And I asked him if I traveled to Sudan, if I could study under Islamic thinkers who had a modern understanding of Islam. Because I have a family with four sisters and very strong mother and father. But the notion that women and men are not equal in Islam would not suit me well as a religion. And so I knew that there probably was a better understanding of Islam out there. I was convinced at the time in my own search that Islam had a profound understanding of monotheism. And in my own search, it had kind of become kind of apparent to me that if there is a God, there's one of them. And so I was very much interested in anyone who could instruct me along those lines. And so I ended up in Sudan with Salman, and a friend of his took me over to meet El Ustaz Mahmoud, and as I was walking up to the house, I was struck by, you know, a flash of white, which was the Republicans going out on Hamla, book distribution, very much like the Jehovah Witnesses do in this society, but in a, instead of going door to door, we used to go to colleges and universities and institutes and into the markets of the towns and cities around Sudan, and we would stand up and we would disseminate information in all walks of life to people. Everything from information on how to pray, how to fast, to commentary on political and social events that were going on in society. And it was in the course of that that I came to have a better understanding of what Ustaz Mahmoud was about. My first impression of him was that he was the most compassionate, most intelligent, most religious, most profound, etc., person I had ever laid eyes on. That was my first impression of him. And it only became strengthened over the 9 years that I was there. That first impression proved to be true. I was once doing book distribution in the town of Atbara, and I went and I was taking the books into this this store of a man, and he asked me what were those, and I told him they were the books of Ustaz Mahmoud, and he said, "Oh, I don't read Ustaz's books." And I said, "Okay," and I was about to leave, and he said, "Oh, no, who are you?" And I told him, and he said, "Oh, you came from America. That's really interesting." I said, "You're not interested in these books?" He said, "No, I don't particularly like his idea about, you know, equality of women and all these new ideas that he has in Islam. But I'll tell you something about him, is that he's a courageous person." I said, "Well, how do you know that?" He said, "Well, I went to school with him. I went to grade school with him." He said, "We had this English headmaster, and that English headmaster used to be very hard on us, and all of us were really terrified of us. And, you know, we were about 6, 7, or 8 years old, and Ustaz Mahmoud stood up to him. He said that there was an occasion when the headmaster said to Ustaz Mahmoud, 'Ustaz, I know what you're up to. Mahmoud, I know what you're up to. I read you like a book.' And Ustaz stood up and looked at him and said, 'Sir, it's apparent you don't understand a word of that book you're reading.'" And this is when he was a child. So this will give you an impression of who he became as a man. And you heard some of that. His ideas about Islam are tremendously important ideas. I was interested in monotheism, as I said, and one of the things I understood from the second message of Islam, and I was able to just absorb it in English. I haven't had a chance to read it in Arabic. My Arabic is not good enough to read it, but because of Dr. Abdullahi, who's in the audience, and it being translated, I think, very expertly into English, I was able to read that book very, you know, a few weeks after being there. And I came across this really profound understanding of monotheism, the idea that all religions are interrelated, the idea that Sharia, Islamic law, is a stage of law that was applied at a particular time in a particular place at the level of understanding of the people at that time. And that in the same Quran that there's a higher level of revelation that's based upon the personal practice of the Prophet, his Sunnah, and distinguishing that personal practice of the Prophet, his Sunnah, from the traditional understanding of it, the traditional understanding being that it's everything that the Prophet said and that he taught to his nation in the 7th century. And Ustaz Mahmud said that's not the proper understanding of Sunnah. Sunnah is the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him's personal practice, and it's the things he said that are reflected in his understanding of God. And if we look at that, we see that that is a higher calling in Islam and a higher degree of understanding and practice than the Sharia. Because in that level of understanding, it's based upon the highest morality of the Quran. In there, Ustaz goes on to elaborate that the morality of the Prophet Muhammad was the morality of the Quran, and that he talked about civilization as being essentially morality. I'm jumping a bit, but let me see if I can tie that together. He said that civilization, properly understood, is in fact morality, and that the he was speaking particularly to the Western world at this time, and I wanted to make sure I tried to share this, is that he was saying that there's a distinct difference between being materially advanced and being civilized, as there's a difference between being urbanized and there is between civilized. He said civilization is when a person does not sacrifice their ends for their means, does not sacrifice their ends for their means. In other words, their means and their ends are consistent. That is based on a moral character. And then that's tied into his understanding of the distinction between Islamic law and Sunnah, because he's saying that by following the Sunnah of Prophet, we're able to also cultivate our own moral capacity through worship. And then he went into a profound understanding of worship, talking about worship is not just praying five times a day, but what you do between the prayers. That the prayer is to reestablish your connection with God and to remember between the prayers, so that you practice the morality when you are interacting with human beings. And that really the only way that you can see prayer in human beings is as it manifests in our interaction with human beings. And we know that in Islam. In Islam, it says the Holy Prophet in one of his hadith said that deen is ma'amala. In other words, it's your social interaction with other people. And so this idea that the prayer is not just the five prayers a day, but it's your interaction with human beings between those prayers, and it's your it's your connection with your Creator, so that you're behaving in a way as if you're being perceived by Him, even when you're not necessarily standing before the public. So you do in private what you do in public. And he talked about this idea of prayer as being a psychotherapy. That this is really important, is that the purpose of prayer is not to please God. The purpose of prayer is to allow the worshiper to become a more moral person and a more unified and complete person. This notion of prayer was a little bit different than what I was seeing articulated in other areas of the Islamic religion, and even before I became a Muslim. And so I was very much impressed with that idea of worship. The idea that every individual is in fact a God in the making is one of his statements. That idea Steve was talking about the purpose is to send every individual in his own orbit towards self-realization. And so prayer as a psychotherapy that can allow a person to realize the God within themselves. And that notion of an individual as a God in the making takes us to then the idea of an individual, and each individual as being an end in and of himself, and not a means to an end. And from here you move to equality, the equality between men and women, not distinguishing people because of their gender or because of their ability level or because of their race or because of their level of material development, but seeing every human being as an end in of themselves. And then he talked again about the idea of, for instance, capitalism putting the machine before the individual. And the Western philosophy as looking at the individual as a threat to the community. He talked about communism as putting the state before the individual. He talked about capitalism and communism as representing Western civilization, and talked about how Western civilization itself had sort of confused, again, material development with civilization. So these ideas, distinguishing, clarifying, I think, the idea of monotheism, looking again at how revelation came at different times and different places to different people, and speaking about Adam, the first human being, as being the first Muslim, and saying that all of the prophets from Adam to present came from the same source with the same message that manifests itself differently in different times and places. So he's talking again about the unity of religion and therefore the unity of monotheistic people, and said that the distinctions that we see between religions and the distinctions that people are making even within Islam really have to do with the fact that the community at different times had different capacities, and therefore the religion took a different form in order to meet the capacity of people during that time. And so that notion led to led to this idea of the renewal of Islam, looking at the personal practice of the Prophet as a methodology that can allow all believing people who adopt it to move closer to their Creator in knowledge. And so he talked about, for instance, the first message as being at the level of faith, Aqidah, or Iman. Yeah. Let's say Iman. That's, okay. So he talked about it. The first the first message at being at the level of faith, and he talks about the Mu'mineen, or the faithful. And the second message being at the level of Muslims in the understanding that Adam and Noah and Jesus were Muslims. Muslims in the understanding that there's an Islam that's higher than the level of the Islam of just if you say that there is one God and Muhammad is the prophet of God, then you're a Muslim. We know that beyond that there's faith, and then there's sincere faith, Iman and Ihsan. And Ustaz then elaborated four other steps on top of that, taking you to Islam again. He talked about the level of knowledge that you gain through intelligent worship, which is what he says will happen when we adopt the Sunnah as the way out of our dilemma, and not confuse the teachings to people in the 7th century with the necessities of people in the 21st century. He said that, you know, the idea that legislation that solved the problems of people so profoundly in the 7th century could solve the problems of people in the 21st century is irrational to adopt that hypothesis. And he's saying that, you know, the thing that's I think important about Ustaz Mahmoud is, you know, there's two aspects, or there's a lot of aspects, but one of them is he has a message to, I think, this civilization, that we need to get our means and our ends lined up. We need to stop confusing our material development with our notion of being civilized, and we need to stop, and which will allow us then to stop using war as a means to solve problems, because we know that's an ineffectual means. It's also immoral, as Ustaz points out in the second message, you know, and for a society, as Dr. King pointed out as well, for a society to be spending so much more on making war than it's spending on the uplift of its people, the social development of its people. That is immoral, and that's an indictment against a society that calls itself a civilized society. So he has that aspect. I mean, his commentary there, I think, is tremendous. But within Islam, the whole notion of distinguishing Sharia from Sunnah and allowing Muslims to not be locked into the notion that because the ayat at Medina, the verses that were revealed at Medina came after Mecca, that those are the ones that are binding forever on all Muslims. Because Ustaz is saying that if we look carefully, we see that the primary verses are the ones that... 1 minute. The primary verses are the ones that were revealed in Mecca, and the subsidiary ones are the ones that were revealed in Medina, which would allow Muslims then to base the renewal of Islam on Islamic texts within the Quran. It doesn't have to come from outside. So what is really profound, I think, is that he's talking about a renewal that can use this final word of revelation from the creator of all humanity as the basis of it. And I think I should stop there.
Thank you, Ernest. And I think we can elaborate more during the question session. Thank you. Now it is Dr. Noor's turn.
Good afternoon, everybody. I would try to tie what I'm going to present here to what is being said by both Dr. Johnson and Dr. Howard. The part I'm going to take here is to present Ustaz Mahmoud's views on a vital issue, which is the Middle East conflict. And actually, he voiced very provocative, actually, ideas in the 1960s. And let me just... this is the title of my presentation, Exploring a Prophetic Vision for Peace in the Middle East. And his views on the Middle East issue actually stems out of his vision for the Muslims and for the Middle East, for the future of Muslims and the future of the Middle East. And I think the significance of Ustaz Mahmoud's ideas comes from the fact that his views provide a framework from the ongoing dilemma in the Middle East, which is especially at this time when Muslim militancy is on the rise and it threatens the peace and it disturbs our civil life. Actually, we can see this in this country after September 11th, how our way of life in this country have changed. I remember I came to this country in 1992 for the first time, and I remember I used to go to the gate to get the passenger who's coming out from the aircraft. You cannot do this anymore. And this is a big setback in our way of life. This country is a democratic country, and it has been practicing democracy for more than 200 years. And now we are in a situation that actually is caused by the threat of the Muslim militancy and all militancies and all sort of fundamental thinking, which is, for instance, Yitzhak Rabin in Israel was killed by a Jew fanatic or Jew fundamentalist. And actually, fundamentalism has no religion. It is in all religions. It is always there is different interpretations for any ideas, and people take sides in every simple idea. Ustaz Mahmoud revealed the essence of Islam as a religion of peace, unlike all other Muslim clerics and scholars. Historically speaking, he never denied that the Muslims conquered the world using the sword. And he said that happened as a result, that is a different time frame and different context. But in today's world, the Muslims, they need to reinterpret, to reinvent themselves, to look into their scripture in a new kind of way that suits the values of the current time. And I think that is the core thing in Ustaz Mahmoud's ideas. And I think his views offer a very good solution for Muslim communities to reconcile modernity with Islam. And actually, Ustaz Mahmoud is not an elitist like other elite Arabs and Muslims who tries to embrace the secular worldview provided by the Western civilization. It actually is very hard to convince the masses to make any shift unless you support your arguments, unless you situate your arguments on the scripture, because people take that very seriously. So Ustaz Mahmoud took religion and he based his views on Islam and on the Quran, but he came with a different interpretation that allows women, for instance, to become equal in front of the law with men. And to say that fighting the infidels is not the core message of Islam. That was just a contextual practice happened in a certain era, which is the 7th century, and it's not actually the original message of Islam. And there are lots of things. Social equity also is the main thing in Ustaz Mahmoud's ideas. Ustaz Mahmoud actually coincides with the theology of liberation, especially when it comes to justice, social justice. And he is very, actually, he also talked about reconciling democracy with socialism. And he always emphasizes that he does, when he says socialism, he doesn't mean communism, but he means social equity. And he thinks that democracy without social equity won't work. Also, trying to achieve social equity without a democratic system won't work. Like this, and he always pointed out the case of the implementation of communism in the Eastern Bloc and how they failed actually to achieve all they promised people with. This is just a general framework that signifies Ustaz Mahmoud's ideas and why they are important today. And those ideas were said long time ago. They were said in the 50s, actually, and in the 60s. Ustaz Mahmoud was executed in 1985. And I think his thoughts are still relevant. And I think also his name wasn't elevated. That wasn't surprising, because Ustaz Mahmoud challenged the most brutal and the most dangerous two establishments in the Middle East, the secular dictators and the Muslim clerics. And that's why he paid his life to make this historical statement. And I think his image is not elevated because he was blocked out. He was eradicated physically by execution. At the same time, his books never circulated. And until this very day, it is very hard to publish things from Ustaz Mahmoud in the Middle East. And I edited a book with just maybe a couple of years ago, and we published it in Beirut, and we struggled with some restrictions that books has to be read by the Minister of the Information before they get released to the public. So there is still, the Middle East is not a free sphere for free thought. There is a lot of hindrance in that regard. This is a book he published first after the defeat of the 1967. It's called At-Tahaddi Alladhi Yuwajihu Al-Arab, which translates The Challenge That Faces the Arabs. This book was published in September 5th, 1967. And that was only 3 months after the war. And he said very strong statements in that book, talking to the Arab nations and to the Arab leaders. The second book came 1 month, I think, after that book, and how can I go back? Yes, Mushkilat al-Sharq al-Awsat, Tahlil Siyasi, Istiqra, Tarikhi, Hal Ilmi, that translates The Middle East Crisis, Political Analysis, Historical Overview, Rational Solution. Umdurman, Sudan, October 1967. That was just 4 months after the war. What was unique about Ustaz Mahmoud's ideas on peace in the Middle East? Is it the time in which it was said? Is it its context or content or both? I believe it's both of them. The content is totally different because his content is based on his vision that humanity is going to unite. That is his premises that he always reiterated, that the future of the humans on Earth, there is no way other than living in peace beside one another. This is the future of humanity. This is his dream. This is his vision. And then everything else stems from this major assumption. He called for peace with Israel in the 1960s, and that was completely a taboo. At that time, nobody in the Arab world would dare to say, let us make peace with Israel. He was the only scholar who talked in public and published book, and he said that it is very important that we make peace with Israel. And in the coming following things, you will see, this is his, I'm quoting him, this is my translation. By the way, it is, I think it just gives you the idea. Ustaz Mahmoud writes very eloquent Arabic, and I don't think I can translate to the level he articulates his ideas in Arabic. But this is my translation in English. I hope that you accept it. It gives you an idea of what he was saying. He said, the most profound lesson in the world of post-World War II is manifested in the fact that the human caravan had dismantled its tents and started heading into a new direction. In every step of this new direction, the human caravan makes history and makes it under a new light. And then the quote goes on, after long ages in which history is dictated to history recorders by kings, sultans, military leaders, politicians, and the wealthy who misled humans from their true destiny, history is now becoming dictated to these forces by the unknown ordinary man who started to push for justice and human dignity wherever humans are found. This is his basic vision. And he said that the world of the post World War II is a new era. The powers that are governing the planet are not going to allow much room for the human dream, but we have to fight for that dream, and to fight for it with enlightenment, not with weapons or explosives. And I think that is what distinguish Ustaz Mahmoud from the rest of the Muslim and the Arab thinkers. Ustaz Mahmoud saw the Cold War and the armed race as signs of the failure of the current civilization. He constantly asserted that capitalism and communism are two faces for one coin, which is the materialist worldview, and Muslims should not waste time in following any of them. All his message to the Arab leaders, don't fall into the trap of the Cold War, because you have your resources, your cultural heritage, and you can come out to humanity with a new vision for justice and for peace. The fact that humanity does not yet know a path to peace other than scaring the rival with arms indicates a global crucial need for an alternative worldview. The Arabs and the Muslims have to stay out of the Cold War battleground if they want to make something out of themselves. So he called for peace with Israel because that is reality. Israel is reality, and it is recognized by the international community. And there is no way to alter that reality. So you have to accept it, because the future, we are all going to live together, no matter what. It might take long, it might take short, but he thinks that is an inevitable destiny for the for humans on Earth. And the Arabs have to stop war, recognize the state of Israel, and go for direct negotiations under UN supervision, because that is the only way for them to stay away from being exploited by one of the two big powers in the Cold War process. That was his core thing. So he said that what the Muslims and the Arabs need to do at that time, that was in the 60s, is to emerge as modern states. That is their priority, not to fight Israel. not to remain in constant military confrontation with Israel. Actually, they have illiteracy, they have poor economies, they have lots of problems that they need to work on. The war is just a waste of resources, and it diverts them from their to undertake their historical contribution. And Ustaz Mahmoud believes that the Quran contains a lot of things that would make a difference in the modern life if it is interpreted properly. By recognizing the state of Israel and maintaining a sustainable peace with it, the Arabs will save the time and the resources they need to emerge as modern nations in the first place. Also, they help the UN, which is a newly born world organization, from being manipulated by the big powers. And unfortunately, all this is happening. Until this very day, the United Nations is just, I don't know, would it be very provocative to say it's a joke, actually, because it's manipulated by the big powers. The veto system itself is one of the manipulation. All nations come to a decision through a democratic process by voting, and then one entity, USSR or USA, can vote against the will of the entire, and that tells you that we are still behind in terms of being sincere about implementing the principles of democracy at the higher level, which is the international organization. We can't do that. Still, the powerful makes the law and implements the law. He is the legislator and he is the judge. The powerful is the legislator and he is the judge at the same time. So as human beings, we need to find a new way. And that also illustrates how the way in which Ustaz Mahmoud really thinks. Now, Ustaz Mahmoud asserted that war track is a dead-end route, and the Arab will never win militarily against Israel. He said, the Arabs do not manufacture weapons, do not know how to maintain them, and even do not know how to use them. And that was so provocative to say. And it's true, because we are not modern nations. We are consumers. I mean, in the Arab world, we don't manufacture. We just import things. Everything we use, we brought from Europe through colonization or whatever. So you can't defy the big powers with all these deficiencies. You have other priorities than fighting. You need to sit down and to rethink the whole thing and to be rational and to be moderate. That's what he was calling for. The Arabs have priorities that are more immediate and more vital than the constant military standoff with Israel. In his book, Ustaz Mahmoud offered the Arabs and the Muslims two solutions. Number one, a short-term one, recognizing Israel in existence in exchange for going back to 1947 UN resolution. And by the way, the partition plan of 1947 was rejected by the Arab nations. And from that point, everything went astray. Ustaz Mahmoud believed that the Arab did a series of fatal errors since 1947. And I think still many of them are making the same errors today. Giving the refugees the right of coming back and compensating those who do not want to come back. That was said in the 60s, and even at that time, Sayyid Mahmoud started to say to some of his followers that it seems it is too late, because the Arabs were losing their bargaining chips increasingly, because they don't face the problems with rational thinking. Number two, a long-term one, and that is to focus on issues of Islamic reform and understanding what the challenges really are. Because the Ustaz Mahmoud believes that the Arab route is a different route, and it could offer humanity a new avenue to the realization of the dreams of peace and justice away from the dominant powers. So they have to remain out of the battleground of the Cold War. and to focus on revival. Because there was a race. Ustaz Mahmoud was racing time. Was racing time because at that time he was afraid that the entirety of the Arab world fall under the control of the Soviet Union. And to a great extent, that was true during Nasser's era. And also at the same time, racing times against Muslim militancy. And now we are facing Muslim militancy. Maybe the dictators are subsiding. The last one was Saddam Hussein. Well, he's not the last one, actually, but I mean the one that really resembles Jamal Abdel Nasser was Saddam Hussein, and he was removed. But still, there is plenty of them there. Nasser's era, Arab nationalism and pan-Arabism, and Nasser's intervention in Arab countries to spread the revolution. That was the backdrop at that time. Nasser was a populist, and he won the hearts of the Arab masses from the Atlantic Ocean to the Gulf in the east. And he had a very strong propaganda machine, and he was following the Soviet model, actually the one-party system, which now is spread all over the Arab nations. In Libya, there is one-party system. In Syria, there is one-party system. In Sudan, in Egypt, just name it. At that time, Ustaz Mahmoud's ideas were ridiculed and dismissed as irrational, as unpatriotic, and especially by pan-Arabism advocates, Islamists, communists, and Ba'athists. But I think things are changing now, because all of these trends lost momentum by time. The Palestinian issue as a means to silencing the opposing views and validating dictatorship, that was what is used by Jamal Abdel Nasser. Ustaz Mahmoud was very strong in pointing out that the Palestinian issues is just used as a means to quiet people and to validate the dictatorships. And this is the slogan, لا صوت يعلو فوق صوت المعركة, which I translate, no voice should ever become louder than the voice of the battle. And this has been like there for 20, 30 years. That if you say anything, oh no, we have a battle with Israel, let these things, this is not the time. And these things go on and on that way. Pointing out the fatal errors. This is how Ustaz Mahmoud pointed out those fatal errors. The rejection of the partition plan of 1947, which it is a United Nations resolution that Palestine has to be divided between the Arabs and the Jews. And then Jerusalem will be run by the United Nations and it will be an international city. The Arab rejected that resolution and started to infiltrate fighters from Syria and those places, and then the first war erupted, and they lost that war. The second fatal error is the nationalization of the Suez Canal. Ustaz Mahmoud said that he is not against, principally he's not against the nationalization of the Suez Canal, but he thinks it was done at the wrong time and for the wrong reasons, especially that the Suez Canal treaty is about to expire according to the initial contract. And if Egypt just waited, that the Suez Canal will go back automatically to the ownership of Egypt. So the whole thing is Jamal Abdel Nasser wanted to defy the West, to become more popular in the eyes of the Arab masses. And that led to the attack by Egypt, by UK, France, and Israel. And Ustaz Mahmoud believes that was a turning point that took the Palestinian issue from its old context and put it into the middle of the Cold War issues. And from that point onward, the whole thing just started to go astray. Nasser's constant aggression towards Israel and his frequent military shows that led to the preemptive strike of 1967 and the war that the Arabs lost. I went recently to a website about Jamal Abdel Nasser, and I was amazed by the number of the military shows he do. Every maybe couple of months, every 6 months, he has a military show. and his media machine is always attacking Israel, is always that wasn't really the right direction, and it just caused a huge disaster for the Arabs. Khartoum conferences of the Three No's, this is the nickname of that conference, the Three No's conference, August 29th, September 1st, 1967. No recognition of Israel, no negotiation with Israel, no peace with Israel. This is just few months after the war. And Ustaz Mahmoud was totally against that, and he thinks that Jamal Abdel Nasser is leading the Arabs in the wrong direction, wasting their time and wasting their resources, and then wasting the reform, the political reform, because he is using the Palestinian issues and he uses the confrontation with Israel to quiet every other voice in the Middle East. This is also a very provocative statement by Ustaz Mahmoud after the war. If the Arabs has to choose, they would have chosen to defeat Israel and throw it into the sea. But instead, we prefer the defeat for them, because victory, according to the way they envision, would have misled them. It would have distanced between themselves and their true mission, and between them and their actual enemy. The state of Israel is not the enemy of the Arabs. And he always says that the enemy of the Arabs are their being living out of the modern world. They need to re-emerge as modern nations and to have true contribution to the ongoing civilization based on their cultural heritage and their world view. The death of Nasser in 1971 led to Sadat's new direction. And Sadat just dismantled all Nasser's establishment. But he empowered the Muslims, brothers, to encounter the leftist and the Arab. Things were turned over. And Sadat did the war of 1973. He didn't win that war, of course, but it gave him a bargaining chip, and then Camp David Accord came, and then Egypt won Sinai Desert back again, but Syria still, the Golan is occupied because they didn't go in this direction. Sadat was assassinated as a result of the peace agreement, and also as a result of the empowerment of the Muslim militants in Egypt. Sadat's line was continued by Mubarak, and Jordan, as a result, recognized Israel in 1994 with a peace treaty. And we hope that all the Arab nations go in the same line, recognizing Israel and sit down to achieve peace. Because it is time that people really concentrate on issues of revival and issues of... I have 1 minute. Okay, I will go with those slides without talking in this minute. This is just pictures of Ustaz Mahmoud, very quickly. Yes. It's a big issue, and it's very hard to summarize everything in 20 minutes. But I think I gave you a general idea about the ideas of this unique thinker. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, my colleague Gamar is going to just say a few things as to round up what has been said.
Thank you. Just a few minutes on to tie some of these major themes, and then we'll open the floor for questions and answers.
And also some questions for the panelists to think about, too. The late Mahmud Taha falls into a cycle of Muslim reformers for about 275 years in Islamic history. What distinguishes his contribution, perhaps, other than those in the late 19th and early 20th century, is his ability to be more comprehensive. For instance, I think, other than the specifics of what our last speaker said, Dr. Al-Nur, Dr. Al-Nur's presentation shows us the specifics of political criticism, social criticism, cultural criticism. And I think one way to think about this reformer is how he falls in sort of a philosophical context. His criticism falls under what I think is a horizontal plane, a horizontal plane dealing with human concerns, institutions, cultural institutions, political institutions, political crises, economic reform, and so forth. But like many other reformers, he just doesn't stop on the horizontal plane. The nexus or the answer to some of the issues and crises is this vertical plane, the vertical plane between the individual and the divine, the individual and the community. And in the book, The Second Message of Islam, translated by Professor Naim, thankfully, there is this important point of what is the meaning of the individual in the middle 20th century. What conditions can be created to create peaceful and harmonious environments for the individual to live with other creatures, as well as the striving for the divine. So his reform is to me, the way I read it, is a critique of not just the outer, but very typical of mystical Muslims, of bringing in the outer with the inner. So the outer is not to just reform Islamic banking, or change the dictatorial tyrant, or change the men's rooms and have gender equality and make more women's rooms at the football stadium, but there's sort of an inner and outer business. His critique is to ultimate peace and ultimate transformation, personal transformation, is to think about moving beyond daily suffering and moving beyond the sufferings that we have created as human beings, and how that transformation can bring us closer to the presence of the divine. This sounds like a wonderful little statement, but in the history of Muslim reformers, this is not a very common perspective. The common perspective is, I am a cleric, or I'm an ayatollah, or I'm a mufti, and because of my training, my expertise and my criticism is going to be within this discipline. And rarely do you step out of that discipline and speak about the Israeli-Arab crisis? Or really do you speak about the problems of capitalism or communism? And so what this person tells us, that there's an amazing level of depth and breadth. And it's not superficial. Let me just give one or two examples. And then for us to think about. For someone to write something like this, the complete liberty and equality for all human beings, and note that he's not saying, where are the lights? There he is. Okay. Let me revise that. The complete liberty and equality for all human beings, and he's not saying for Muslims or Christians, agnostics, atheists, or Americans, for all human beings, regardless of sex, religion, or faith, as it stands now, this means that Islamic law has to move beyond discrimination on the grounds of sex and religion. This was written in 1964. It's a very, I think, profound, revolutionary statement for a reformer to think about. One of the things to reach a harmonious horizontal and vertical plane is to think about the laws that were set up or interpreted. Another thing that I think is interesting for us to think about is that he's a person thinking on the long lines of absolute individual freedom and individual inner peace as well as outer peace. And he said that as long as an individual can never achieve absolute freedom as long as this person is divided with himself, with one part at war with the other. He must restore unity to his being so that he may be at peace with himself before he can attempt to be at peace with others. Which brings a very important point within Islamic Reformed writing. Very little work is done on what the individual responsibility is to do about reform, but what institutions must do. So if you look at some of the reformers from South Asia and in the Middle East from the late 20th century, it's institutional problems. First, it was a colonial rule. First, then it was the clerical class. Then it was the lack of Islamic rulings or the Islamic law. Or it was the secular state. Or it was Abdul Nasser. It just goes on and on and on about the other. But here he places the ultimate responsibility is on the individual in terms of reform. Internal reform is definitely connected to internal peace and external peace. His critique on that some of these things within Islam, so again, I want to put this in the context, is very revolutionary to see this in the 50s and 60s. His critique of the notion of Muslim interpretation of jihad. So that was a mistake. This notion of gender separation and this overemphasis of men and women being separated for the fear of sexual enticements. So that was also a misinterpretation. And this is probably the most, and I think there are other scholars here who can speak about this more than I can. The use of the veil is also part of the first message or part of a particular context, which is not, which has been misread and abused by clerics and the Islamic legal class. And he calls these types of discriminations or prejudices a way to submit and make people conform. And that needs to, which dampens one's peacefulness. So, in a nutshell, what I think is going on, and I'd like the speakers to respond to if it comes up, maybe through other questions. What he's trying to do, I think, is ask Muslims to think about the notion of a stagnant religion, a stagnant interpretation that has been codified. And what he's asking for a break of the expert class, the clerics, who, once there is an expert class, right, then sort of all that responsibility, oh, that's what the theologians, muftis, qadis do, and I, as an individual Muslim, don't have to worry about this. I'm just a baker. I'm a business person or whatever. So this sort of attacking the control of the theologians is important. And I think what he's breaking is not only the control of that, but a psychological dogma and ritualistic thinking of religion and faith in modernity, which he sees is a problem. And with this, as a response to secularism, as a response to communism and the Cold War, that religion is going to be another casualty in sort of this separation and sort of codification of different spheres. So I think what he's doing is trying to bring a greater sense of responsibility to individual Muslims and take that to another level where the horizontal and vertical meets. And maybe we can bring this up to in conversation. Thank you. If you have questions, we have a microphone. Yes, sir.
Now the floor is open for questions. Comments.
We have a microphone there on the on your right side.
Yes, I want to thank you, gentlemen, very much. I'm only beginning to understand this amazing and wonderful person, and I'll be studying him more. The question I have to do has to do with Israel, and specifically for Professor Elnor Hamad. Am I pronouncing?
Yes, correct.
Correctly? Pretty close. And that is my sense in the quotes that you gave were very much that he was very pragmatic about Israel. And I got much more of a sense of being pragmatic than coming from the divine within people. And of course, to speak that way in public about Israel would probably not have been too strategic to get his ends. But I'm wondering if your sense in studying him is that he really felt, he really lived, he really believed of the divine within Israelis. Or is this pragmatic sense his main thing? Did he? Do you think he felt and lived that there is the divine within within Israelis? Yeah. I'm a little emotional as I say that, being half Jewish, but I'm asking a question.
Okay. Actually, this is a good question. And Ustaz
Noor, can we ask you to write down the questions?
Sure.
So that this thing is not to let people stand waiting for it. So we receive a number of questions, and then we ask our panelists to answer, just to respond to it. Yes, please.
I join my colleague in thanking the panel for their enlightenment about this scholar. And my question is, with all the disadvantages that Gamal Abdel Nasser has brought on the Arab world, how do you explain his popularity, and in some countries until now, to the Arab people? Thank you.
Okay. Yes. Please.
Hi. Actually, I have a comment more than a question. I'm a Palestinian living in Jerusalem. I'm here since 1 month only. I'm here for the 4 months professional development course. I live in Jerusalem. I'm Palestinian. I carry an Israeli ID and Jordanian passport. I just have a comment about the issue that the only solution is the negotiations and the recognition of the Israeli existence. Actually, it's a big failure if we can only look at least the Palestinian experience. We're going from one failure to another. We as a Palestinian and me as a resident of Jerusalem, which is supposed to be the capital, we're suffering every day. We're being killed every day. We are suffering checkpoints, being humiliated, away from the media, away from the recognition of the whole world. I don't know. Negotiation, in my opinion, must be between two parties who have similar opportunities, similar strengths. I don't offer a solution. I just say that I do not agree with that the only solution is the Israeli recognition. Also, I have another comment about the Gamal Abdel Nasser issue. Every and each Palestinian consider him as the most respectful leader. And I don't want to talk on the name of the rest of the Arabs in the Middle East. He's one of the most respectful leaders. And about being hide behind a slogan that we have a battle, at least at his time, people were being made silent because of an honorable reason, even if he was being behind that reason. Now people are being silent without any honorable reason. So I wish that we will have another leader as Gamal Abdel Nasser, who really made our voice honorable and reachable for the whole globe. And I want to remind you with a sentence which the Israel channel broadcasted on the day of Gamal Abdel Nasser's death. They said, "The honorable enemy died." And this sentence was not said about any Arab leader which got into any peace process with the Israelis. Thank you.
Okay. Please.
This is a comment, a quick one, hopefully. I think what I've heard today in the thematic way of discussing things from the panelists, theology from Abdullah Ernest and sociology from Steve, and international politics and also the thematic strategic thinking of Ustaz Mahmoud, I think gives us a very powerful insight into how the individual, the universe of the individual within, and you know that's Abdullah Ernest's theological reading of Ustaz Mahmoud, and Steve's talking about the universe of you know the layer of the universe in community, and the possibility of the Republicans as a community of possibility, that's another layer of that universe. And then Steve talking about the planetary Earth universe and how Ustaz Mahmoud saw it. And there is also maybe a mega aspect or layer to that, and that is Al-Ustaz Mahmoud's seeing of the individual and society within the universe itself, the universe as a whole, and the connections that those that relationship brings into bear even in our day-to-day lives. This is a comment from maybe another day, but it seems to me that that's where the genius of Ustaz Mahmoud is. As a Republican myself, a Sudanese Republican, I'm an American, but I'm not an American Republican. I'm not going to tell you what I am. I'm not either. A Democrat, but democratic, and that also tells you how we perceive the world in this country. In my judgment, the way Ustaz Mahmoud saw not only the life of the individual as a universe within which God Himself resides, and by the way, in Ustaz Mahmoud's theology, God is not a male. He's not a female. He's not a male. So when you say himself, it's not a matter of. There is also another discussion to that that can maybe take place some other time, but when God resides in the individual, the whole universe resides in the individual. So in that sense, international politics falls. Our sister's comment on Jamal Abdel Nasser, I agree with you partially. Jamal Abdel Nasser rose, Arab dignity and pride to a level that was never preceded. But the content of his character, in my judgment, and his politics were not wise, as Ustaz Mahmoud has pointed out in Anur's presentation. Actually, Ustaz Mahmoud said what you said about Jamal Abdel Nasser himself. He said that his intentions were good. He was a good person. But the way he conducted himself was what Anur just pointed out. Let me real quickly make this announcement. This very quick announcement, and I'm here actually what I came for. Tomorrow, at Georgetown University Conference Center, there's going to be a follow up for this. Actually, an extended maybe. Discussion of what we have just started, and this is part of the commemoration, the 21st commemoration of Ustaz Mahmoud's martyrdom, and the theme for that is Martyrdom for Freedom, and it will start at 2 p.m. and end at 6 p.m. So there are four hours, and I hope that everyone here would show up, but if not, you'll be with us.
Thank
with
you very
heart.
Much, Haider.
Thank
actually, we were planning.
It's at Georgetown Conference Center. Georgetown University Conference Center. You will ask at the reception there, and they'll tell you what conference hall. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We are planning actually to make this announcement at the end of the event.
Dr. Anur, the difference between fundamentalist and extremist. It seems you are a little bit sensitive about this, because I can see Mahmoud himself as a fundamentalist, because fundamentalism in Arabic is usuliyya, which is the root of things. So you can see that he is a fundamentalist, even if the word now is كده شكله ما ظريف. But I don't see him as an extremist. Extremist has no religion. We all know this. But I can see that while you were talking, you said, fundamentalism has no religion, which is extremist, not fundamentalist.
Thank you. Yes, please. We'll take this as the last question, and then we give the opportunity to our panelists.
Thank you so much for this conference. Actually, I get a lot of information. I'm doing the same dissertation about the impact of modernization on the traditional Islamic societies. So actually, my concern about does Ustad Mahmoud discuss the Shia and Sunnah or Ismaili at the same sects, or he has different point of view? This is the first question. And does he made kind of the role of political participation in solving the socio-economic problems as a result of the modernization in the Middle East? Thank you so much.
Okay.
I want to go.
Who's going to start? Most of the questions were addressed to Anur, so it gives him the first opportunity.
Okay, I'm going to respond to the first question, which is
what is referred to as a pragmatic position with regard to acceptance of Israel as a reality of the post-World War II, and whether there is a divine... So actually, Ustaz Mahmoud, in his book, The Middle East Crisis, made a whole chapter on the... Actually, on the history of the Jews in the Middle East. And it was written very thoroughly. And there is a lot of support from the Quran itself about the story of the Jews in the Middle East. And he ended up to the conclusion that the claim of the Jews in the land of Palestine is not totally false. And but he believes that also mentioned that the Jews needs to reinterpret the scripture the same way the Muslims need to reinterpret the scripture, and that they are not preferred as let us say the chosen people of God for any ethnic reasons, but for as long as they are able to carry the essence of the monotheist tradition. And he thinks that Islam, Christianity, and Judaism are one thing. Actually, they are a branch of one body. And he sees maybe Christianity on the right-hand side, like, turn the other cheek. And then Judaism, eye for an eye. And he thinks Islam is something in between to bridge those two things together. This is his view of the whole religious traditions of the Middle East. And he spoke about the Jews in Mesopotamia, in Syria, and in Egypt. And But he thinks that the future is for a unifying understanding of the scripture. And this has to be done by Muslims, Jews, Christians alike. And it's not just a pragmatic thing. And he thinks that just would give the Arabs and the Muslims a moment to just rethink their hostility. They need to think of the issue under new light, because the ultimate thing that people are going to live together no matter what at the end of the day. The popularity of Jamal, also this is the second question, was addressed to me. Yes, Jamal was popular, but I don't think this because of the merit in inherent in his messages as much as because Hitler was popular. And the Germans were so fascinated, yes, and he mobilized them against the entire world. So it is not. I mean, being popular doesn't mean. What I'm saying here, by the way, I have respect for Jamal. And as Haider said, that Saz Mahmoud said Jamal Abdel Nasser was a good man. And he has good intention, but he said that good intentions are not enough. You need to have vision in order. Anyway, the bottom line thing is that the popularity is not the determinant factor in a value of anything. Yep. And negotiations also was mentioned. By the way, Ustaz Mahmoud said this a long time ago. Maybe Ustaz Mahmoud said what he said in at certain moment in time where the Arabs had some strong bargaining chips, but they lost their chips by errors. Because at some point, I'm quite sure, Israel was so desperate for making peace with the Arabs, and they could really negotiate and strike very good deals with the Israelis. But they insist on throwing Israel in the sea, and that what made them constantly lose bargaining chips. And I think things went astray since the 60s.
Permit me to add one thing. At the end of Nasser's rule, accepted William Rogers' proposals, yes, which was peace with Israel. Mm.
Yes. Okay. That
she neglected to say.
You
didn't
know. That's history. I would go quickly. Fundamentalism and extremism. Actually, the sometimes translations are really are a little bit problematic. I agree. Sometimes fundamentalist means that you adhere to the origins of a discourse of whatever, and people use it to illustrate fanaticism in some way or extremism. But in the Arab in the Arabic it is clear. For instance, Ustaz Mahmoud never used those. He used for us as Salafiyin, means that the people who adhere to some interpretations from the past. So I think there is. I'm not defending my using of the words of. Say it again. Fundamentalist in the sense that he originates his ideas on the scripture, but not in the sense that he thinks he had a stagnant understanding of the scripture. He calls for renewal every time. And he thinks that even the scripture is not the final thing. Ustaz Mahmoud, he thinks that the scripture itself is the means. The end is humans. So you never use the scripture against human ends, no matter what.
Yeah, I think I just add to that, if I could.
Go ahead. Yeah. Come on.
Yes, please, let's...
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Let's listen together, please. Yes.
Yeah, my recollection is that Ustaz Mahmoud preferred the term Salafi, which would be translated as traditionalist, and he felt that the term fundamentalist, as it was used in the West, was actually unfortunate, because fundamental means getting back to the fundamentals, and that's not what the extremists are doing. Okay, so the piece I wanted to kind of comment on, and I wish that the gentleman hadn't left, so this young lady would have a chance to talk to someone who lived under Nasser. I didn't, but I think
my dad did and my mother did.
Okay,
and they really appreciate him until the moment, and they reflect the opinion of the whole people
right
living in that era.
And the only reason I was sharing that is because, you know, we. If you grow up in a society where you're oppressed, you see, then it's very difficult to hear a positive interpretation of your oppressor. I understand that. But at the same time, I think it's important sometimes to get different perspectives, because that helps us get a broader understanding. That's all I was saying. I wanted to comment on something else. That was just
let him
sharing.
Just let him finish.
Thank
you very much. Okay.
Yeah, not to get into this. But the piece I thought that was really important was this relationship that Ustaz Mahmoud talked about between the individual and the community, the individual and the universe, and this was brought up, I think, by Haider. And I don't think, fully elaborated, but one of the comments that Ustaz made was about Western civilization, that being a fundamental problem with it, not really having yet reconciled the relationship between the individual and the community and the individual and the universe. And the individual and the community, that was mentioned earlier, being the issue of trying to reconcile democracy and socialism, and not necessarily seeing them at odds, but coming to a social system that provides for both political justice and economic justice. And you know that we really suffer with that in our democracy right now. And economic justice leans towards some type of socialist ethos, and that just seems to be a failing with the West. And the other thing is the individual in the universe, and this gets to that discourse around Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And Anur was mentioning that in the second message is understanding they are a trinity, they are interrelated, they all came from the same God to the same humanity. Right, and they are the same religion. That's fundamentally rational to look at it that way, and that they manifested differently in different points in time. And really, the significance of the second message is to point us towards Sunnah as a methodology. And what Sunnah gives you, which is the personal practice of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is it gives you a methodology that can allow you to develop the calmness of heart and the clarity of mind to turn the other cheek. You know, because we realize that that's a lofty teaching. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, we know that that was appropriate at a time. That was the law. That was the Sharia at a time. And it was better than go kill everybody. No, be just, one for one, an eye for an eye. But that law was improved on and said that we can do better than that. We can move to turning the other cheek. And that requires a profound understanding that we are living in a deterministic universe and that our Creator is the hand behind the hand. And when you forgive that person that's harming you, that is essentially belief in God. That is an intelligent understanding of God. And so that notion of Islam as the middle way between Judaism and Christianity allows it, you know, leans towards the notion of it being a psychotherapeutic method, allows us to have a clear mind, calm heart. So in those instances when we are oppressed, when we are feeling the pain, we do have the ability to remember that God exists, and that's not outside of his purview.
Thank you.
Could I ask one quick follow-up question?
Just let me ask whether Steve is having any comment. Okay, yes, please.
Very brief. Could you just tell me one thing? Was Taha's thinking and his movement, is it mainly a Sudanese movement, or did it spread to Muslims beyond Sudan? We're still talking about him 21 years after his death, so how big is the movement still today?
Who is going to take this question?
I guess Steve. With the exclusion of the two of us up here, that it's a Sudanese movement. Microphone.
Can you come?
Oh.
Yes, please.
Okay.
Yeah. There are a few Egyptians, and the numbers are. It's a controversial subject, and I guess there are. Classifications there. In a sense, it was very difficult to be a Republican brother or sister. It was a very rigorous devotional method, and subsequently, in terms of real, true, diehard Republicans, probably never numbered more than. And everybody's going to scream about this. I'll say 2,000. Families, let me put it that way, but with lots and lots of friends, sympathizers, benefactors, people who were respectful of the Republican way of doing things, but it did not get the attention it deserved as a movement in terms of its path-breaking influence, as has been described up here. For a variety of reasons, it was very much suppressed. It was forbidden from the mass communication means in Sudan. No use of the airwaves, television, radio, and so forth. And had to distribute its books on foot, largely around the country. So it was a remarkable fact that more than 2 million copies of the 200 or so publications were distributed largely hand-to-hand, on foot, all over Sudan. But it was a Sudanese movement overwhelmingly, really.
And today, where does it stand today?
Well, that's a good question. You want to answer that?
Yes.
Bill?
I just want one comment I think I will make. I believe that, you know, as Ustaz Mahmoud says, that this is the time of the individual. And it's a time where individuals and nations are looking for solutions to their problems. And I believe that in Ustaz Mahmoud's reinterpretation of Islam, there are clear solutions to people. And an example would be, I had a student who was very devout, raised in a very traditional Islamic family, and she knew my thinking, and we had many debates back and forth, and even though the ideas were appealing to her, it was very difficult for her to embrace something so different than what all of the religious scholars are saying. You understand? And so what happens is she traveled back home, and she went to her to visit her uncle, who is considered to be the scholar in her entire extended family. And there on his desk is a copy of the second message of Islam in Arabic. And he is saying to her, she says, I know that book. I know him. She said, oh, he said, no, you can't know him. He was killed in 85. No, my teacher followed him. And it went on to her husband, to her her uncle, saying to her that this is my teacher. I consider him my teacher. And so I believe that that type of future does exist for these ideas. It's just a question of when people are willing to take the time to investigate. But I believe the solutions are there.
And if I can, I may add. Okay, you can have last question. Yes, please. Thank you. It's clear now. Who is going to take this?
I'll take it. Actually, the movement was very strong in Sudan. Ustaz Mahmoud started his movement very early at the Republican Party. At that time, it doesn't have any clear referral to his new ideas. And that was in the 40s during the struggle against the British rule. And he was actually the first Sudanese prisoner. In a political prisoner against in the struggle against the British. Later in the 50s, he went in seclusion, as Al-Baghir just mentioned, and then he came out with his ideas for renewal, transformation, and so forth. The movement was very strong. He's a very charismatic leader, very persistent person. And very charming person as well. I joined the movement when I was 20 years old. At that time, I was just in the first year in college. And I remained in the movement until his execution in 1985. And we used to work day and night consistently. And just to spread pamphlets, to conduct debates in the universities, in the streets. And we traveled all over the towns and villages of Sudan, just promoting his ideas. His killing was a moment where his followers dispersed. Many people seek refuge in Western countries, in Western Europe, in Canada, and in the United States. And some of them are still remaining in Sudan. Also, Sudan fell under the grip of the Muslim extremist. The current regime started very extreme, actually, in 1989. And the movement, there was no room for the movement to go. My personal understanding, Ustaz Mahmoud's ideas are actually they are way ahead of time for what is going on in the region there. And I think it's people are going to resort to it down the road. And sometimes it's not just the merit of the idea and the clarity of the idea. Sometimes historical events, people has to go different routes to realize that this idea is what they really need. It's not we don't always perceive things just by our minds. We need to get into certain kind of experiences to understand that this idea is really what we need. I think that his ideas are really potent, and there is a lot of potential in them for the future of the Islamic world. Actually, I don't see any other way for the Islamic world to emerge in a modern way and to refrain from extremism and militancy without embracing the ideas of Ustaz Mahmoud. But maybe people need to learn it the hard way, to try other things, and then when they fail, they come. Just like his vision for the Middle East, for instance. It was stated almost 40 years ago. And now only two Arab nations recognize Israel. But the track is going. I mean, whenever that people, for instance, PLO is going for peace, and then suddenly Hamas comes and work against PLO. And then you have these two confused messages. On one side, people are negotiating with Israel. They are going with the roadmap. On the other side, people are conducting suicide bombing. It just became, the whole thing became, but there is no way other than peace. It is quite clear now. And the taboo was broken, that talking about recognition of Israel was broken, because Israel is a nuclear power right now. Anyway, I think the idea sometimes comes ahead of time, and then people resort to them after time. And I think this is what is happening to Ustaz Mahmoud's ideas. During his time, he was the engine of this because of his charismatic nature and his determination. He's an exceptional person. He's just like, if you want just to get, just think of Dr. King, the marches and the struggle, and he changed the face of America. But this didn't happen in one day. The ramifications come later. And I think that is what is going to happen in the case of Ustaz Mahmoud's ideas in the Middle East.
Thank you very much. Now I give the opportunity to my colleague, Kamar, just to make a closing remark and some announcements. Please wait for the announcements.
Thank you. Thank you. Again, this is just on behalf of the Institute. Thank you for attending this panel. And, of course, thank you for the panelists for coming and presenting their ideas on Islamic reform. Again, another plug for tomorrow's event, which is from between 2 and 6 at Georgetown University, at Georgetown University Conference Center. You can get that on their website, georgetown.edu. And we look forward to future meetings. Thanks again.